This is On Design, Monocle's weekly show on the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today.
Flying home, I've often found myself soothed as soon as I can make out its sparkling sails through the clouds from the tiny plane window.
As the Sydney Opera House marks its 45th anniversary and a century since the birth of the celebrated architect behind it, we visit the landmark to find out what the contours of Jorn Utzon's controversial work can offer. We'll also speak to design consultancy Pentagram's latest partner, sound designer Yuri Suzuki. All that plus the latest from the design pages of edition 1 of Monocle's just out winter weekly newspaper, coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. He drew his inspiration from countries and cultures across the globe, creating bold, ambitious buildings that sought to reinvent our relationship with the natural world. Yes, the Danish architect Jorn Utzon would have hit his centenary in 2018, and the landmark has prompted a series of re-evaluation of the maestro's sometimes lauded, sometimes decried work. A new exhibition at his best-known building, the Sydney Opera House, celebrates his impact. Here's our report by Olivia Rosenman in Sydney, who set off to find out what Utzon's insight might still offer us all today.
At one hand, it was at the edge of what was possible of its time, exploring building technologies that weren't even invented yet.
In 1957, a 38-year-old from Denmark entered a competition to design a national opera house for Australia. He was a relatively unknown architect with few projects to his name.
And at the same time, it has this ancient, timeless dimension.
According to local legend, his entry was initially discarded. But after it was rescued from the reject pile, Jorn Utzon's submission was chosen as the winner from 233 entries from acclaimed architects and design firms from around the world. It was little more than preliminary sketches, but its sculptural curves stood out from the square shapes and straight lines so popular at the time.
I mean, this building doesn't just revoke memories from the past. When you see it, you have a sense that this building is going to last forever in the same way that the pyramids does.
The Opera House is Sydney's icon and one of the 20th century's most famous buildings. It is the centrepiece of Sydney Harbour, built on a site sacred to the first Australians who lived there, the Gadigal people, for thousands of years. It's a source of pride for most Sydneysiders, myself included. Flying home, I've often found myself soothed as soon as I can make out its sparkling sails through the clouds from the tiny plane window. This year marks 100 years since the birth of Jorn Utzon, the mastermind behind the Opera House's bold and visionary design. It's also 45 years since the house was officially opened, and a series of special events have been planned to mark these anniversaries. On a rainy late spring October morning, I sat in the Opera House with Lena Norskov Eriksson and Lasse Andersen from the Utzon Center in Utzon's hometown in Denmark.
My name is Lena Norskov Eriksson, and I'm a head of exhibition at the Utzon Center in Aalborg, Denmark.
Yeah, my name is Lasse Andersen, and I'm the director of the Utzon Center in Aalborg, Denmark.
The Utzon Center is a Nordic hub for architecture and design. The building in which it is housed, in the city of Aalborg, was the last project designed by Jorn Utzon before his death in 2008. Utzon was 90 years old. Both Lena and Lasse are Utzon experts, so I started by asking them about the origin of Utzon's inspiration for the Opera House.
So the Opera House is quite complex in terms of where he got the inspiration from. I mean, immediately when you see the tiles and the geometry of the sails, you're transported to the great mosques of Persian architecture. That was provided a huge inspiration for this particular building. But the basic idea of this building is the idea of the platform and these floating, almost cloud-like roofs. And the platform is something that he discovered on a trip to Mexico in 49, where he traveled across the border from America and went out into the jungle and saw these huge platform temples nested in the jungle. And what he says is that the wonderful thing is that even though the platforms were built thousands of years ago, when you walk up the steps, step by step by step, you immediately feel elated. I mean, it's almost an existential experience of being in the world under the sky when you stand on top of those platforms. So that had a huge impact on his world. So whenever he builds public buildings, more or less anyway, if the site allows it, he usually uses a platform, because a place like the Opera House, for instance, it's not just a house or an office building, it's a place of celebration for the arts. And he really saw it as a temple for dance and music. So when you walk up the steps, it prepares you for the magnitude of the experience that you're about to have. And the sales, of course, is inspired by the harbour environment, but also, I mean, as his work evolves, he becomes more and more interested in clouds, and he's quite interested in the floating roofs of Chinese and Japanese and Nepalese temples. And he says that once you have a platform, if people are to experience the platform and the quality of the platform, the experience that it can bring to a project, it's important what you put on top of it. Like a flat roof, for instance, doesn't express the monumentality of a platform. So he became interested in these pagoda roofs, which are almost like the crown of a tree or floating clouds hovering just above, because they use platforms as well to elevate your experience when you enter the temple.
When Lena describes a floaty, fanciful feeling of elation while ascending the steps to the main concert hall, I can immediately relate. Walking into the Opera House for an evening show is a dreamy experience. In front of you, the bright white sails soar up against the night sky. Behind you, the harbour sparkles with the reflection of downtown city lights, and the illumination of the harbour bridge completes a magical trifecta. But how did a Danish architect draw inspiration from mosques and temples and ancient Mayan ruins?
The first thing that you need to understand is that his approach to architecture grew out of the 40s in Scandinavia. So the Second World War had just finished, and people understood that there's something in Western culture that we had lost or forgotten. I guess a humane dimension. Technology had been used for mass extinction of places and people. So people were quite conscious on the problems that comes with an excessive use of technology. And a real sense of humanism and a desire to recast a greater relationship between the way the people live and the ways of nature grew out of that. And Utzon traveled because he was interested in cultures that weren't cluttered by a modern way of living. So the places that he traveled to were rural settings in the margins of the world. I mean, he traveled to Morocco, Mexico, America, Native America, India, China, Japan, places like that, where architecture is based on a more poetic relationship to nature.
Utzon's curved organic forms represented a significant challenge for the building engineers tasked with constructing the massive concrete shells. When they asked him to define the shapes of the sails, Utzon famously took a plastic ruler, bent it against the table, and simply traced the curves. Needless to say, his measurements, if you can call them that, turned out to be structurally unsound. While Utzon and the engineers spent months looking for a solution, conflict began to brew in the government. As the budget and the timelines blew out, the relationship between Utzon and the government completely broke down. Utzon infamously resigned in February 1966, 7 years after construction had begun, and already 3 years later than the completion date initially planned. He left Australia and never returned. Not when he was given the keys to the city of Sydney in 1998, not when his 2003 Pritzker Prize citation described the Opera House as one of the great iconic buildings of the 20th century, and not when the Opera House was designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 2007. I asked Lena how she reflected on the bitter controversy that ultimately ended in Utzon's resignation.
Utzon was quite Buddhist about it. I mean, at first he was frustrated and angry and sad, naturally, because this was his life's work and it had taken up all of his hours for so many years. And I mean, once you get an opportunity to build on this site in Sydney with that program, I mean, as an architect, that's an extraordinary opportunity. You really have an opportunity to do something great for the world, right? But eventually he became quite Buddhist about it. When people asked him about the whole story, he was like, such a long time ago, why don't we just let it be? And sometimes he even referred to Gothic cathedrals. I mean, it wasn't a singular architect completing Gothic cathedrals. It was a generational work, and generations of architecture contributed. So you could also look at it that way, which is a kind of a comforting idea that this is not, I mean, Utzon's masterpiece, but it's a work of Sydney, in a sense.
Our sincere thanks to Olivia Rosenman at the Sydney Opera House. We'll be back for the second part of that interview a little later. But next up, it's a primeval pleasure. But is there an effective method of designing a fire? Canadian artist and designer Martha Sturdy is known for her wearable sculptures, once the jewellery of choice for fashion doyens. These days, the Canadian's designs take place in the countryside where she burns reclaimed cedar to showcase the natural beauty of the wood. Monocle's Will Kitchens in Vancouver reports.
A cedar tree, charred by a wildfire and with its insides hollowed, stands in a thicket on a valley floor near Pemberton in British Columbia. Martha Sturdy, the 76-year-old Vancouver-born artist, sculptor, and designer, who owns a huge plot of rugged countryside 2 hours north of her native city, says she couldn't make a sculpture as good as this. It's got texture, movement, and height. It's got power, yet you could just walk past it. Sturdy's jewelry, or as she insists, her wearable sculptures, graced the pages of Elle in Vogue in the 1970s and 1980s, and were the favorites of designers such as Oscar de la Renta, Jeffrey Bean, and Donna Karan. As her stature grew, so did the scale of her work. Her studio has since produced furniture for clients including Louis Vuitton and Saks Fifth Avenue. At this January's Maison and Objet in Paris, the brand's geometric table and chairs, built from primary colored poured resin, were showstoppers. In 1991, Sturdy arrived in Pemberton, a town of 2,000 people, and converted a sawmill into a second home and studio. Sturdy says that as an artist, you have to always look, learn, and listen. Here, in her backyard, fallen cedars have two fates. If they don't become jumps for her horses, they are chained to her bright orange tractor and dragged along a gravel road to a nearby fire pit. This sandy corner of her property is where Sturdy transforms salvaged cedar into blackened benches, stools, and sculptures. Today, chopped firewood, its interior stuffed with dried kindling, has been set alight. Sturdy takes a fence post that's nearly double her height and lays it over the fire to char one edge. Sturdy's creations are inspired by her surroundings, but also by her many visits to Japan. Charring wood is a traditional Japanese practice to defend against wildfires and rot before it's used as cladding on a home or a fence post. Sturdy says it seals the wood from bugs too. After 20 minutes, she removes the blackened fence post from the fire and sets upon it with a wiry brush. The charcoal exterior crumbles, revealing deep brown edges. The natural grain will become pronounced once the wood is oiled. For Sturdy, this enhances its natural beauty. Sturdy notes that when she wants color, she works with resin. She loves steel too. It's rusty, crude, and aggressive. But she says with wood, she's honoring how it grew, its curvature, and the way its veins run. Her work is characteristically minimalist. Vertical sculptures stand on simple black plinths, while a bench is built from three perfectly proportioned blocks. Today's fence post will be part of a larger sculpture, but for now, Sturdy is admiring its details in isolation, its lack of straight lines especially. She says it makes her feel pretty insignificant, and that's the beauty of being an artist. You've always got an opportunity to learn if you're paying attention. For Monocle, in Toronto, I'm Will Kitchens.
Many thanks, Will Kitchens, for that report, taken from the pages of Monocle's Winter Weekly newspaper, part of our How to Build a Fire series. You can find the next issue on newsstands from Thursday this week. Now, a little earlier on, we talked about the Sydney Opera House and its architect, Jørn Utzon. The Utzon Centre in Denmark has launched Utzon Unbuilt, a competition that invites young designers to reimagine the maestro's drawings for some of his unbuilt and unfinished projects, a theatre in Zurich, an opera house in Madrid, and, of course, the Jeddah Stadium in Saudi Arabia. Here's part two of our report.
The ongoing memory of Utzon's work is the reason Lena and Lasse are in Sydney today.
We're opening an exhibition in the Western Foyers and on the boardwalk. So we're here to open an exhibition on his work, and then we're focusing specifically on how his work was inspired by his travels around the world. And it's a theme that we think is appropriate for the time that we live in, but it's perhaps even more appropriate for a place like the Sydney Opera House, which is visited by so many people every year from everywhere. It's such a magnet, isn't it, for architecture tourists? So, I mean, hopefully they'll visit the exhibition and they won't just discover something that they did know about his work, but they can also begin to see their own building culture appear in his buildings.
As well as the exhibition, they're launching a new competition that will give some of Utzon's work new life in the 21st century.
We are launching a new prize competition for young talent under 40. And the idea is to put a light on the things that were never built, the unbuilt Utzon, it's called. And as Lina said, the things that Utzon did had really a tremendous impact on the places he built. But he was also, you can say, a stubborn architect. And you have to be stubborn to create a masterpiece like the Opera House. And we interviewed Renzo Piano, the architect behind the Pompidou Center, and he said he admired Utzon for his famous stubbornness. And being stubborn, there's also a lot of projects that are never built because you have a high standard. So we have an archive in Aalborg at the Utzon Center called the Utzon Archive. And we will, over the next 3 years, we will take one project a year that was never built and put up a competition where young architects, designers, multimedia designers, digital artists, whatever, can give their contribution on how could it have looked if it was built by digital means. So that's basically what we're doing, taking unbuilt projects from our archive and say to young talents, give them new life and show us what we actually missed out on.
But Lasse also hopes the competition will demonstrate what Utzon's work still has to offer us today.
There's an example. It's perhaps one of the most famous unbuilt projects in the history of architecture. It was a museum for the Danish artist Asger Jorn, the biggest Danish artist in the 20th century. He formed the Cobra movement. And he asked Utzon, while he did the Opera House, also to do a museum for him in a Danish town called Silkeborg. It was an underground museum, really fantastic. And we brought that to life some years ago, digitally, actually by a young, very talented architect that worked for us. And after that project, people came to us and said, okay, it would have been amazing. The curator for architecture at the Guggenheim Museum in New York, Troy Conrad Therian, he said this would have been a pilgrimage site if it was built. And I'm going to that city in a couple of months to give a talk because they're doing a new museum. And they would like the architects doing the new museum to somehow get inspired by what was going on back then in 1963. Not to build that museum, but to kind of pick up on important themes in that when doing a new museum. So in that sense, I think that we also could kind of tap into a contemporary architecture discussion using the things that Utzon never built. And I think that's really important because we're not a normal museum. We are not supposed to kind of only look back. It's really important for us that we, of course, keep the legacy of Utzon, but we also say, how can he inspire us to look forward?
Utzon's Opera House attracts more than 8 million visitors from across the globe every year. Had he reached his 100th birthday, he would surely see this as a testament to his vision and ambition in creating a building that brings together and welcomes people from everywhere in the world.
Many thanks to Olivia Rosenman in Sydney. And if you're keen to see more of Utzon's lesser-known work, then you can always see his seemly residence that we profiled in the latest issue of The Forecast, an annual magazine from Monocle that's on all good newsstands now. The remit of designers is always growing. They are often called up to use a variety of different disciplines and tools to communicate an idea or a message behind a brand, and design firms are adapting accordingly. Last month, design consultancy Pentagram announced an unusual new partner in its London office, the sound artist, designer and electronic musician Yuri Suzuki, a man who's collaborated in the past with clients from Audi and Google to Panasonic and Disney. Suzuki recently stopped by Midori House to speak with Monocle's Brisbane Brogue design editor Nolan Giles. The pair discussed why sound is ever more important to the world of design and why Suzuki was at first caught off guard when Pentagram invited him to become partner.
So you joined Pentagram at the start of this year, and you've said that your mission is to be developing and expanding the field of interaction, experience product, and sound design. That's quite a broad ambition. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience at Pentagram so far?
Pentagram approached me to join a company 2 years ago. Pentagram is an incredibly interesting process to be partner anyway, so it's whole process taking 2 years. It was really surprised they asked me to join because it's really out from what they do. Like, because my understanding for Pentagram, it's more about the branding, graphic design. But conversation is amazing because 2 years I have to meet each individual partners, have to talk about it, and they have incredible diversity and also openness for creative thinking. So I was really impressed, like, how as a partner think. But sometimes still, like, my area is brand new, and still, like, a couple of partners really don't understand what I'm doing too. But they're always fascinating about, like, what I'm doing. But at the same time, these days communication is really diverse, not only visual. For example, more of tech things develop a lot. Some people doing like kind of augmented reality or like virtual reality and so on. And the really meaning of the communication design is really broad now. I believe like they want to put some new blood, something increase like a new field of the kind of communication design. And I was thinking a lot for these 2 months, like what I can contribute to Pentagram. But fundamentally, we want to expand field of the communication design and also communication method as well. And I thought my practice could contribute well in that context. But of course, it's going to be quite like a difficult journey, I understand too.
When you look at your work, everyone enjoys it. It's quite universal. What is it about sound and interaction and playfulness with sound that brings out joy within human beings, no matter what age?
Majority of my project installation and more about very short moment, a customer coming in, experience brand philosophy through the installation. And then sound is really strong because it's more direct, and to compare with visual, somebody's taking time to understand what's happening anyway, but sound is immediate to pop out. If action and also sound are linked perfectly, it's really, really strong and instant like interaction we can find out. So I believe that side of the sound property. I think sound aspect is always strong and also direct and also quick to understand. That's why I'm keep using sound as a medium, I think.
Lots of our listeners are maybe interior designers and architects. Maybe in that design equation of a space, sound gets factored out a little bit. And I just would love to hear from you what sound can deliver in terms of providing an emotion and an experience within a space.
Particularly something I want to design is something soothing sound and people to relax instead of stressing out because of reflecting to the functions of that space and how they use for a long time. First of all, like, I always using particular noise called white noise, like, which is really effective to soothing people and also creating silence. And it's exactly the same technology as noise-canceling headphone. White noise is really representing really natural record sound, such as wave and so on. So we have what kind of oscillation in the wave and kind of white noise volume is changing constantly, creating sort of like soundtrack based on like what I created. Frequency is really set to not hurting ear or anything. And also like lower frequencies, just vibrating your body. So we just like carefully like design sound and also what kind of speaker we use as well. in total was combination between physical, for example, pendulum creating sort of Doppler effect and left to right ear, and which is also quite good, like affected human like emotion in a way. Problem of the sound design or like sound affect the human's emotion is quite difficult to prove in a scientific way because it's all about emotion. It's hard to say what's the right way to do. I tested quite a lot in my studio and also trying myself, asking for other people.
Can you explain a little bit about the workings of the collaboration that you did with Audi at Salone del Mobile this year?
Yes. Audi is basically they do every year like some sort of project in Milan Salone, and it can be installation or it can be like display the car or like some new technology like demonstration and so on. But that year was particularly quite interesting year. There's one space called Seminario that's basically monks' school in the past, and I think like a Pope like he used to study as well, and a quite special place. That was first time ever opened to public, like after 40 years or something, quite a long time it was closed, like never opened to the public. And even people living in Milan never know about that place. And that was a very special occasion. And they came to me really, really last minute, actually, in like December. And can you think something really respect to the space and something like we can talk about like brand philosophy, but we don't need much, you know, Audi logo or anything. Like you can free to think about anything. So that was amazing brief, but same time really scary brief as well, too open in a way. But we proposed a couple, and also they wanted a particular sound base, and they believe like sound communication is quite strong. So that was quite nice trust between the client and us. And we proposed a couple by then, and they particularly like one project called Sound Pendulum.
And you ended up with these kind of beautiful pendulums swinging through the massive courtyard area with ambient sound. I mean, it's quite a kind of moving emotional experience for people. And I'm guessing you got that feedback from people that enjoyed it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But at the same time, like, it's not something about you know, instant excitement or anything. People just stay and sit down. And then some people, like, just left after 1 hour and coming back in the afternoon as well. So I can see, like, different enjoyment or, like, appreciation for the installation. So that's really nice to see.
That was sound designer and Pentagram's latest partner, Yuri Suzuki, speaking with Monocle's Nolan Giles. Sadly, that's all we have time for today, but next week...
I think it drives designers crazy because they feel like, well, everyone's just falling in line. But, you know, you're trying to communicate with the consumer as well as the designer, and you want it to feel right.
We look at the complicated reasons behind the simplification of fashion logos. And don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our sister podcast, delightfully named Monocle on Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You can also pick up the latest copy of the magazine, one of our winter weekly newspaper series, which are out every Thursday in December, or one of the many beautifully bound books we publish. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by Kenya Scarlett and Cassie Galpin. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.